Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We will be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is yet again, Chris Kirk. For those of you that remember Chris, he is a PhD researcher at Liverpool John Moores University, where he is assessing the physiological demands of mixed martial artists. I've invited Chris back on to discuss some of his most recent papers, the first of which is the first piece of evidence in the literature to demonstrate that weight regain after cutting weight is not associated with competitive success in high-level mixed martial artists. I'll let Chris explain his findings and talk about what this could mean for athletes and coaches, but this is a really interesting episode that challenges many common beliefs that are held in the combat sports world. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live, so back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So Season 4 has seen a few return guests coming back on. We've got another one with us today, Mr. Chris Kirk, Associate Lecturer at the University of Derby and PhD Researcher at the prestigious Liverpool John Moores University. Chris, thanks for coming on, mate.
No problem. Thanks for having me back, Geordie.
What I want to talk about today is, for anyone that kind of follows the space in combat sports science, you guys just this week or last week or very, very recently anyway, have just released a paper called Worth the Weight, which looks at, which I would say probably the first piece of literature in the evidence base that we have that has assessed whether there's an actual competitive advantage from cutting weight in high-level MMA athletes. Chris, let's get straight to it. Can you tell us a little bit about this paper? Talk about how you went about going about researching it, all your methods, and then what you found.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, it is the first paper looking at these things in high-level MMA, but it's actually the third paper looking at whether there's any effect on performance of weight cutting. But this is the first one using high-level fighters in the UFC and Bellator. And how it came about was essentially through me following the sport. I knew a couple of years ago the California State Athletic Commission had introduced a new rule where, as well as the 24 hours prior to the fight weigh-in, they also instigated a day of the fight weigh-in as well. And what they were actually trying to do with that was to try and understand how much weight athletes are regaining after they've weighed in for their official competition. Because up until that point, we didn't really know. No one had really run a study to try and find out how much weight fighters were regaining after they'd weighed in. So the California State Athletic Commission had been collecting this data for about 3 or 4 years now, and there were 5 events that they released the day of weigh-in results out to the media. So 4 of these were UFC cards and 1 was a Bellator MMA card. So I started scrolling through MMA Junkie, Sherdog, MMA Fighting, trying to find all these results. And once I collected these 5 events together, I literally just called someone at the California State Athletic Commission and said, can I use your data? Can I do a study on this data to try and find out whether the winners or losers of the fight were regaining more or less weight than their opponent? Now, previously to this, Victor Coswig in 2018, I think it was, he did a lab-based study with 10 fighters in each group where they both cut weight and then both regained weight. And they found that the fighter who regained the most weight won the simulated bouts that they had. Then last year, I can't remember their first name, but Breshne, I think they're an Irish research group. They studied, I think, 96 or 98 amateur fighters, again, doing the same thing, weighing them the day of the fight after their pre-fight weighing. And they found no difference. In actual fact, they found that the losers of those bouts regained most weight. Lost most weight rather than regained most weight. So we decided to actually use the California data, compare the winners and losers of all the bouts in every division in terms of how much weight they regained and how much they weighed when they stepped into the cage. And what we found was that there's absolutely no difference in the amount of weight the winners and losers are regaining. and no difference in terms of how much they actually weigh when they step into the cage. Now, the types of statistics we use were a branch called Bayesian statistics, which I don't want to get into the weeds of the specifics of the stats in this podcast. I know I don't want to bore the crap out of your listeners just yet. But this type of statistics can actually, rather than just saying if the groups are different, it can tell you whether you should believe the hypothesis or the null hypothesis. And for a couple of the conditions that we looked at, so we also looked at whether they, whether it made a difference, whether the fight ended due to strikes, submission or decision. For decision, it actually supported the null hypothesis that there is not a difference in the amount of weight regained or how much the fighters weigh once they're actually in the cage. So this straight away tells us that if there's no difference in winning or losing, depending on how heavy you are or how much weight you cut and regain, then we need to start looking at how much fighters are actually cutting and regaining and whether that amount of effort is worth it. So what we also did was we had a look at the fighters' weights when they're in the cage in comparison to the division that they're fighting in. And what we found that half the divisions, the fighters are stepping into the cage weighing close to the upper limit of two divisions above. So featherweight fighters, when they're in the cage, they're actually around the weight of a heavy welterweight. Similar with bantamweights, they were at the upper limits of lightweight. Now, in the heavier divisions, so welterweight and above, it was the same sort of story, but they were only going up one division. But they were still going up to the upper limit of that division. So middleweight fighters were stepping into the cage, essentially being the same weight as a big light heavyweight. Light heavyweight fighters were stepping into the cage as an average heavyweight. So straight away, this, well, just from a competitive standpoint, it kind of shows that the weight classes aren't really the weight classes that we're seeing in reality. Now, this also says to us that they are cutting extreme amounts of weight, with light heavyweights cutting around 9%, and down to lightweight, featherweight, bantamweight, they're all cutting about 12%, with flyweights cutting about 14% of the body weight. So this is a huge amount of mass that the athletes are losing and regaining in a short space of time without any actual real benefit. You could understand this process if the winners were heavier in the cage or had regained more mass than the losers, but they're not. So essentially our recommendations for this paper is that if everyone cuts half the amount of weight, so rather than cutting 12%, if they cut 6% of the weight and everyone moved up a weight class, everyone will be facing the same pool of competition. They'll be facing the same fighters, but they wouldn't have those negative, potentially life-changing effects of such rapid weight cutting and such extreme weight cycling. But then that brings on to the next discussion of, well, how's that going to happen? How are we going to convince fighters to move up a division? We know that we're not going to be able to force them to do that. So it very much comes down to a culture change within the sport. How do we go about changing the weight cutting culture to reduce how much weight they're cutting and making sure that they have healthier careers, longer careers, less deleterious effects, but they're still facing the same opponents? So that's that was essentially the recommendations of our paper. And that's pretty much what we found, that weight cutting to the extreme levels we see doesn't actually give the fighters an advantage once they're in the cage, because everyone's doing the exact same stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to put Carl under the spotlight here, Chris, and I'm going to shift total blame over to him. When I spoke with him at the start of the year, he actually gave away some of these stats to me, and I was just about to go on a nationwide tour through New Zealand, and I actually talked about these stats in a couple of the seminars that I gave. And if we're talking about making change to these athletes, this is something that kind of surprised me a lot, is the response we got when I spoke about these results, is that, and these athletes really resonated with it. And I think when we're talking about this discussion about what do we do to fix this, I think we keep doing exactly what you're doing and putting this good research out and raising this question and saying, hey, look, this long held belief that, you know, this competitive advantage and cutting more weight gives you this may not be completely true. And hey, look, we've got a really well-designed study and a really, you know, and fairly good evidence from this study that suggests it is not true.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's only going to be one part of the story, because you can give people evidence until we're blue in the face, and that's what we do all the time. And you can show people that this isn't necessarily the best idea. But when you speak to fighters and say, well, would you cut less weight if you knew you weren't getting an advantage? Their first response tends to be, well, if the other guy stops cutting weight as well, then yeah, I'll stop cutting weight. But there, I think the big issue with weight cutting, and this has been shown a couple of different times, that it tends to be almost like a psychological crutch for the fighters to think, well, I'm going through this process to cut weight. I'm going to make sure I'm going to be ready and sacrificed and prepared for the fight, and I'm going to do more than the other guy. And like Carl's research in Taekwondo has shown, and that he's publishing at the moment, I don't think it's necessarily a case of the fighters wanting to be the bigger person in the cage. I think they just want to avoid being the smaller person. So I think it's going to be a case of I think it's already been demonstrated to the fighters that it's not necessarily the best thing for the health or the performance. And I think a lot of them do understand, just from going through that 48-hour process of sitting in the sauna for 8 hours, dripping the last ounce of sweat from their bodies, I think they realize themselves that it's probably not the best for their health, but they don't want to give up the potential advantage to the other guy. So I think it's not just a case of presenting the data. I think it's a case of convincing everyone to work together, fighters, coaches, governing bodies, promotions, to try and change the culture. And I think it's going to take quite a long time to do that, because it is very much ingrained. But it is things like this that can start the ball rolling on that. But I think it is going to be a case of culture change rather than just hammering people with data. The data is just the start of the program, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Chris, within this data set that you got from the California State Athletic Commission, were there any outliers or any of the athletes that, say, didn't cut that much weight in the data set, or were all competitors, no matter what division they in, both athletes that were competing against each other cut similar amounts of weight? So were there any big discrepancies between them?
The only big discrepancies that we found really were fighters who cut a large amount of weight. So I think it might have been featherweight or bantamweight, where the winner of the fight actually cut, I think it was close to like 16% of the body weight going in. They're only ones like that, but he still managed to win his fight. The only real outliers, well, the only ones that stood out were in the lighter weight classes. So guys cutting extreme amounts of weight in bantamweight and flyweight. But yeah, there wasn't anyone that didn't cut a large amount of weight, to be honest. The losers in lightweight were the lowest ones overall, and they only cut about 5.8%. But that was on average, and their range was quite wide as well. But yeah, they were the lightest ones.
And we were talking a little bit off air there, Chris, and I guess a big, like we're talking about moving this research forward, is you kind of have to talk to the athletes in terms of performance. And like we were saying off air, right now, we don't necessarily know what the effect of any of this has on performance. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this there's quite a few studies in wrestling now, not many in boxing, and a couple using MMA fighters. But what they tend to do, what they tend to look at pre and post weight cut, are things like maximum voluntary contractions, so using one rep max protocols, using sprint protocols, using sled pushers, and essentially measuring how well they're able to perform in fitness tests before and after the weight cut. And a lot of these studies tend to have very differing results. So some of the studies will show that there's a big effect on performance in these fitness tests, and some will show that there's very little effect on these fitness tests. Well, there's a couple of problems with those types of studies. The first one is that ethically, they're only ever allowed to cut around 5%, which we know is very, very low. It's probably about 40% of what MMA fighters cut. It's probably about 20% less than what wrestlers cut. And probably the only combat sport where 5% is accurate for what they cut might be boxers. And that's very weight class dependent. The other problem with that is that there's absolutely no evidence that the fitness tests that we use are predictive or related to MMA or combat sport performance. So if we were doing a weight cutting study on Tour de France cyclists, for instance, that'd be pretty straightforward because we'd work out their power to weight ratio before the weight cut, work out the power to weight ratio after the weight cut, and that would give us a really good indicator of how they would perform when they get on the road. But in combat sports, we don't have anything like that. It's such a open skill-based sport and such a multi-skill-based sport, and we still haven't really rounded out what the fitness requirements are of the sport, that we don't have any measurement of understanding whether it is going to affect their performance or not. So I think these studies that look at fitness tests pre and post weight cut, they might start to give us an idea, but until we really understand and appreciate what physically the fighters are going to have to do once they get in the cage and what the key determining and predictive characteristics of a fight are, I don't think we're really going to understand whether or not weight cutting does have such a negative or positive effect on performance. And that's something that's come through from the research myself, Carl, and James have been doing over the last couple of years, that at the minute, we don't really know how to predict whether or not someone's going to perform well in the cage from a physical standpoint. From a skill standpoint and from a technique standpoint, I think coaches have that pretty much nailed down at the moment. But from a physiological standpoint, we're still looking at a black box. We still don't know at this stage. So in terms of predicting whether weight cutting is affecting that, we're a couple of steps behind there at the minute.
So we don't quite know where we're at with the performance, but I guess from the data that you've looked at, Chris, and looking at these numbers, what would be your assumption making what this effect may potentially have on the athlete's health, say, if they're cutting, 9-12% before going in this competition?
In terms of health, I think Andy Casper's paper from a couple of years ago that I think Carl spoke about the last time I was on, actually, where they did a case study on a British fighter, and they took blood samples throughout his weight cut, looked at his liver health and looked at the biomarkers of his physiological health. And those numbers show that at the point where he was ready to step on the scale, if any doctor had seen those numbers, they'd have had him booked into a bed in their intensive care unit. They wouldn't have been saying, right, go and strap on those gloves and go and get punched by that bloke who's been training 12 weeks to kill you. Yeah, the health side of this weight cutting, I think, is becoming more and more clear. But we still need more data, such as the Andy Caspi paper, to really highlight those differences. Now, what we don't know, and what no one has ever tracked, is the long-term effects of weight cutting on the athlete's health, and whether this damage to the liver is a long-term effect, or whether it can be recovered through a week or so of recovery after the fight. But this is one of the key things we're doing, is to look at what is the long-term effects of weight cutting on an athlete's health. But again, in order for us to research that, we have to get ethical approval. In order to get ethical approval, we have to show that we're not going to damage them by asking them to do 7 weight cuts over the course of 18 months whilst tracking all these metrics. But I think it's probably safe to assume that going through that amount of physiological strain on top of 12 weeks of training for a combat sport, and then on top of the concussive blows taken in the fight, I can't see any way that there's anything but a negative effect coming from this amount of weight cutting. Now, if the weight cutting's reduced, does that mean that there's a safe limit to weight cutting? Again, we don't know. The data just isn't there, which makes it even more imperative that we need to reduce the extreme amount of weight cutting seen, because we know in the short term, just before they step on the scale, there's severe negative health effects. And because we don't know what the long-term effects are, I think just from a safety standpoint, let's try and get this extreme weight cutting under control. But there's too little data at the minute to say either way whether it is a long-term negative effect or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before we start talking about the other research you've been going into, Chris, let's go over it just one more time. Your recommendations from this paper, can you run through that again? Was it that even if these guys go up a weight class and they cut half of the weight, they'll still be competing against the same guys, just not as drastic of a weight cut?
Pretty much, yeah. But that would only occur if everyone went up a weight class and cut the least amount and cut half the amount of weight. So because everyone's cutting 12-13% at the moment, if everyone decided to cut 6%, move up a weight class, you're facing the same guys, but you've not had to drain yourselves in those 2 days prior to the fight. And I think some fighters are willing to do that. Like, there's been a couple of cases before. I think it might have been Josh Thompson a few years ago. He was just about to weigh in with his opponent. Oh, no, sorry, it was about a day before the weigh-in. And he just happened to be sat next to his opponent in the press conference. And he said, "What are you weighing at the minute?" "Oh, I'm weighing 160. He goes, "Let's fight at that. Let's just do that. Let's not bother with this, with putting ourselves through hell for the next 24 hours. Let's just stick with that." So I think some fighters are willing to make the change, but I think it is just the case that they're all concerned that if the other guy doesn't do it, I'll be at the disadvantage. So our recommendations are that everyone move up a weight class, but that is going to take quite a bit of convincing on behalf of the fighters, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Chris, let's go on to the other part of research you were looking at. I spoke about with Dr. Corey Peacock when he was on the podcast about his catapult system, how he's using the catapult system, rather, to assess, you know, training load and everything. You've been looking at this in this time off. What have you found?
I've been using the catapult system for a few years now in my research. My first few papers were showing the reliability of the catapult system and then using it in 3-round simulated sparring bouts. Now, the reason why I think the catapult system might be so useful is for what we were talking about before. We don't actually, because we don't have any method of directly measuring the performance in MMA, then having some sort of accelerometer attached to the fighters during training, during their sparring bouts, could actually give us that method of measuring how much work they're doing. Because in most of the sports, in football and rugby, they're able to track how far they've run, how many sprints they've performed. In Tour de France cycling, they're able to track the power output. In track and field, they can track times. In MMA, we don't have anything like that. But the catapult system is a small unit that sits in between the shoulder blades, and it tracks how much the athletes are accelerating up, down, left, right, front to back, and how much impact they're experiencing as well. So over the last summer, I wrote a paper with Dr. Howard Hurst and Dr. Stephen Atkins, looking at our old data that we took from the sparring bouts and reanalyzing that to see whether the catapult system can monitor pacing over the course of a 3-round bout. So what we did, we had 6 participants who did 1 sparring bout each, and we broke down the player load metric, which is the data that comes out of the catapult system. And player load is essentially, it's supposed to be a metric showing how much work and acceleration the athlete has performed throughout their performance. So we broke it down on a minute-by-minute basis, and you can actually see quite clearly that the pacing and the amount of work the athletes are doing changes each minute. So over the first round of the sparring bout, we have 4 minutes of relatively static workload. They're pretty much staying at the same amount of work, and then a big spike at the end of the round, in the last minute, where both participants all of a sudden start being a lot more active and start accelerating a lot more and doing a lot more work. And then at the start of the second round, it starts to dip, and then there's a big spike again. And then over the last half of the sparring bouts, there's 1 minute of increased intensity, and then it just starts to collapse and go down until the end of the bout, showing fatigue. So this straight away highlights that we can use this system to pick out how the fights might be changing and how their fatigue might be changing over the course of the bouts. Now, we looked at whether we also use video motion analysis alongside the catapult to try and pick out if we could relate what the player load is showing us to what they're actually doing and what we can observe them doing. And the player load metric had a perfect relationship to total active time. So we recorded just how much time the fighters were moving in the cage, and it had a perfect relationship to the player load data. Now, we also tried to find a correlation to grappling time, striking time, clinching time, all the different things you can do in an MMA fight, and it wasn't correlated to any of those, which suggests that the catapult system isn't biased by either or striking movements, because in football and rugby, they've actually found that the player load data can be skewed high or low, just dependent on how much running the athlete's done, or dependent on how much walking they've done. So you could have one athlete do a lot of running, or sorry, you could have one athlete do 10 minutes of running, and one athlete do 60 minutes of skill-based work, passing and shooting, and they would end up with the same player load, just because the first athlete has moved faster. But it seems in MMA, we don't have that bias. We don't have that skew. So it doesn't necessarily matter if they do more grappling in that session or if they do more striking in that session. The payload metric might actually give us a fairly accurate indication just how much work in total they have done. Now, this is only preliminary at the moment. As I said, this study was only done with 6 participants. It does need a lot more work doing in it, and it was also in simulated sparring bouts. So getting it used in live competition, I think, will be the next step, which, given that amateur competitions in IMAF tournaments, they wear rash guards, that might be an opportunity for us to do that. But we've also been using the catapult system in training sessions as well to try and get a measurement of external load of training, which is how Corey has been using the system over in Florida. And we've found that, again, this data is still being analysed, so I can't go too much into it, but essentially we've found that the external load we're measuring through player load actually matches up with the drills and the types of MMA training that we all assume are the most intense. So as soon as you say to an MMA fighter, what's the worst bit of training? They say wrestling straight away. They say that is by far and away the most intense. And player load reflects that. Player load for the wrestling drills and the wrestling sparring is by far and is the highest and most intense drill that you could get. But what it's also allowing us to pick out is how much time is, if we compare it to how much time they're spending on these drills, then they're spending the least amount of time on the most intense drills. So as well as telling us the external load of a training session, it's also allowing us to pick out and start to see patterns in whether the coaches are periodizing or whether the coaches are adjusting their training sessions based on how intense the different sections are, which we didn't necessarily think would be the case prior to doing this study. And in conversation with a few coaches and asking them how they organize their sessions, we didn't think it'd be the case either. But this seems to show that they are subconsciously planning the sessions to have the least amount of time spent on the most intense sessions. So we've used the catapult system to get the external load of wrestling drills, striking drills, BJJ drills, striking sparring, BJJ sparring, BJJ sparring with strikes, wrestling sparring, MMA sparring. So we're starting to develop essentially a picture of what the external load is of the different parts of MMA training. We're hoping to get more data about what the external load of competition is, so then we can start to get an idea of what the fighters are actually doing in training and in competition, and how can we marry those two things up. Because up until now, there hasn't been any training-based studies performed. There hasn't been any training-based data either for internal load or external load in the literature. So we've been using the catapult system to really highlight what they're doing in training, when the most intense periods are, when the least intense periods are. Now, whether this pattern of the coaches periodizing and organizing the training sessions to balance out the most intense and least intense sessions, even though that doesn't appear to occur within the training session, whether that occurs over the course of the week or whether that occurs over the course of the training camp, we don't yet know. So it might be a case where there's no changes in intensity week to week, where there's no changes in difficulty of training week to week. But we are still analysing the data to try and find those patterns and try and describe what the training practices of MMA fighters are, so we can start to tweak them and perfect them, really.
Hey guys, quick interruption here, but well worth it. You guys know that I work with a lot of fighters at world-renowned City Kickboxing, and if you've ever been to CKB, you'll notice that almost all the fighters are wearing Engage fightwear. I'm talking everyone. They're all wearing Engage gloves, shinies, headgear, shirts, shorts, and even slides. When I say everyone, I'm talking guys like middleweight champ Israel Adesanya, featherweight champ Alexander Volkanovski, lightweight champ to be Dan Hangman Hooker, Kai Kara France, Brad Riddell, and Shane Young. They're all wearing Engage, and they're all wearing it because the gear is not like any other fight gear you would have used before. The gear is custom made with top quality material and is by far the most stylish gear you'll see on the mats. So you can see for yourself, Engage has sorted my listeners out with a 10% discount code. All you need to do is apply TFD10 on checkout so you can see why everyone is repping Engage. All right, back to the show. So Chris, from this data, if you looked at all of the external loads for the type of different type of training sessions, would it theoretically be possible to say, go into a gym, talk to a coach, see their training schedule, and then better periodize their training based on the current training loads? Or would you guys be looking at putting out almost an ideal training schedule for MMA based on these, on this data that you're finding?
I think it'd be very difficult to design an ideal training program for MMA simply because of the range of different skills and techniques we have in the sport, the range of different styles that fighters like to employ, and the different approaches that people have to competition. So just from club to club, you could have one club where all the guys are really good wrestlers, really heavy against the wall, really good takedowns. So for us to try and say, right, this is your training program based on what we collected from a gym where they're very striking heavy, I don't think that would make sense. I don't think that would work. So I think it would be a case of the data we're collecting almost being a reference tool of this is the external load of a typical striking session. This is the external load of a typical wrestling session. So speaking to a coach, what do you want to focus on over the course of the next 6 weeks? Okay, these are the external loads we think we have for each of these different types of training. Let's see if we can balance those up based on what you actually want to do. So I don't think it'd be a case of us recommending a type of training program. I think it'd be more a case of giving the coaches tools to understand the load that what they want to do is going to put on the athlete and being able to balance it up better using our data. I think that's the best way of using this. Because we like I said, with the sport like football, most of the teams and most of the players are going through the same sort of thing and trying to achieve the same sort of thing. In MMA, that's not the same. It's not the case. Some guys are better at striking and want to focus on the striking. Some guys might be, even within striking, some guys might be very high volume. Some guys might be counter strikers with very little volume. So I think trying to shoehorn everyone into one box, I don't think would work. So I think our data is mainly going to be used as a reference tool to help them plan out what they want to do more than this is what you should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And it's very much needed in the field as well. So Chris, last thing that you've been working on during all this COVID time is this paper with Carl and James talking about the gaps in the knowledge that you found from assessing all of the relevant evidence and literature in the space. Can you tell us about that and what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So this actually started out two years ago. We started out doing this, and it was essentially a task that James sent me when I first started my PhD to start to gather as much of the MMA literature as I could so we could start to pick out what the key questions were. And so I started just strolling through all of PubMed, all of Google Scholar, all of ResearchGate, just trying to find every single MMA paper that I could find. And I think we found in total 96 MMA performance related papers. We found other ones around psychology and sociology, but that's not my background, so we pushed those to the side. So we decided to try and organize these papers into some sort of structure. And James is a big advocate of the ARMS model, of the applied research model for the sports sciences, which allows you to develop a hierarchy of the evidence that you have, going from very foundational evidence, which is just describing the problems that you have in your research base, all the way through testing at each stage up until it's implemented and it's a method used by coaches as standard. So what we started to do was we assessed every single one of these papers and looked at what the paper was showing us, looked at the strength of the outcome, how well it can be used, how well it can be applied, and put them into the arms hierarchy. Now, what we've found is that almost, I think, 70% of these 96 papers were descriptive in nature. So they were just describing the body composition of MMA fighters, or they were just describing the time motion analysis of an MMA fight. There's no papers that have described what the physiological requirements of a performance are. There's a couple that do take internal load biomarker measurements, but it's not describing whether or not they are good or bad, or whether they were a positive thing for the fighter or negative. There's none that provide predictive experiments of whether or not doing this in training would allow this fighter to win or lose. So essentially what we've got is a literature base that is very descriptive and isn't flowing in a logical order. So we don't have one study leading on to another study, leading on to another study. They all seem to be disparate, isolated questions being asked without any long-term planning of how do we make the fighters better? How do we help the coaches improve their practice? So we have this paper currently under review, and our recommendations are that we need to bring MMA research right back to stage one. We need to bring it right back to the beginning and perform studies that are going to tell us what is the internal and external load of competition and training. What do the fighters actually need to be able to do physically to compete at the highest standards? And what are the physical effects of training and competing, and how do we mitigate those? Because at the minute, there is nothing in the literature about any of those topics. There's a lot of time motion data. There's quite a few strength and conditioning papers saying that this is what you should do to make a fighter better. But without having the data in place about what they actually need to be able to do anyway, how do we know that that particular strength and conditioning method is going to make them better? So essentially what we're recommending with this paper is, let's everyone get back to stage one. Let's build the foundational knowledge and understanding of what the athletes are actually doing and go on from there. Because I think we have jumped ahead of ourselves a little bit in the early stages. Because again, we say this every time, MMA is such a young sport. We know next to nothing about MMA as a physical activity. The in terms of technique and skill, I think the coaches have done an amazing job. If you look at fights from just 3-4 years ago, the level of technique and ability of the fighters is light years ahead of where it was even 3 or 4 years ago. But our understanding of the physiology of the fighters, it's still back in 2001, in my opinion. So we as scientists and support staff, we need to catch up to what the coaches are doing so we can help them improve over the next 10, 15 years as well. And that's essentially what the review paper is talking about. But that's under review at the minute. Hopefully that'll be out in the next couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Hey, Chris, so what is the result of better understanding the physiology of the fighters? If we say that, yes, the technique and it as a sport is developing and, you know, calf kicks have come out of nowhere in the last 6 months and all of a sudden that technique is dominating the sport, what will happen to the sport once we start understanding the fighter's physiology?
I think it would be a case of improved health for the athletes themselves, improved health for the performers, which has the knock-on effect of longer careers, more productive careers, and they don't have such deleterious effects on their health when they retire and move on. From a standpoint of looking after the fighter, I think that's the most important thing. But from a fan standpoint, from the standpoint of someone who wants to see entertaining, exciting fights, I think being able to ensure the athletes are optimally prepared physically with as little fatigue from training and weight cutting as possible just means that the performances are going to be better. We're going to see more exciting fights. We're not going to see as many fights where in the third round there's very little happening because both fighters are tired. So I think it's going to help improve the performances overall. It's going to allow fighters to have more consistent performances. And I think it could actually get to a point where we don't see you see some fighters after 30 fights They might be world champion the next fight. They look terrible and they never look the same again. They just step off a cliff performance-wise. I think that will have a lot to do with the training methods that we're currently using and the type of preparation that we're currently doing, just putting too much on the athlete's body where they just can't recover and respond anymore. I think having a better understanding of the physiology is going to allow us to better manage that so we don't see that sudden, complete, catastrophic decline in performance that we do see both in the third round and later on in careers. But the most important one is just the health of the fighters. They're already doing a sport which is, it's not great health-wise, being punched in the head and being there, being slammed on the ground. So if we can make them more robust to that and protect them when they can be protected around training and post-fight, I think that's the most important thing. Actually make sure the health of the fighters is looked after. And that starts from understanding what's actually happening to them in their training and in the fight itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that is resonated a lot with health professionals. I think it's two things that, yes, if you look after your health, there's more longevity in the sport and there's more opportunity to make more financials. There's more opportunity to make more money within the sport. And I think it's also something that we keep preaching to all these guys is that there's a life after fighting. And by doing this and looking after yourself, you're ensuring that you've got a better quality of life after you do retire. Hey, Chris, Liverpool John Moores always has things going on. You guys are at the forefront of research in this area. What are you yourself and the team out there? What's happening down there in the future? What do you guys have coming up?
Well, as soon as we can get back in the labs and get some work done. We're still on with our study where we're tracking MMA fighters pre and post training camp, where we're taking them through a series of physiological tests and fitness tests alongside measuring their body composition pre and post. We're still recruiting for that. So as soon as fights start occurring over here again, which could be in the next couple of months, could be in 6 months, we don't know yet. But as soon as, if you're an MMA fighter and you want to get involved with that study in England, give us a call and we'll get you into the labs and we'll get you tested pre and post. And from that, we'll also be able to work with you to start to plan out your next training camp, to work with your coaches to essentially make it more specific to what you actually need as an athlete. Alongside that, we're also starting to talk and discuss with IMAF about working on their coach education pathway so we can start to integrate some of the data and integrate some of our findings into what the coaches are actually doing, because that's the most important thing that we need to do. At the end of the day, if you talk to the fighters, there's only so much the fighter can do because they have to listen to the coach. It's the coaches who make the difference here. So we're starting to work with IMAF, hopefully going to be producing some educational materials for the coaches on their coaching awards, and hopefully going to be getting out to the tournaments that occur next year. Obviously, 2020 is a bust. There's not going to be any tournaments this year. But hopefully the tournaments next year, we'll be able to get out there and get some competition data collected as well.
Right. Absolutely brilliant. And just quickly, Chris, if people are listening, if you're active fighter in England or anywhere around there and can get around Liverpool John Moores, just to reiterate, all of this is completely free, right? And they can come in and they get all the testing done and they get a world-class facility and they get world-class practitioners at no cost to them.
Yep, absolutely. If you're a fighter and you need support, you need testing, you need advice or working with, come and speak to us at Liverpool John Moores and we're here to do it. At the end of the day, we need participants. You guys are the participants for our study so we can find out more about you and help you more in your careers. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to say that if you're in the UK and you're listening to this and you're a fighter and you don't take that up, I'm not going to say you're silly, but I'm going to say that you're pretty close to it. So, Chris, thanks so much, mate, for taking the time to come on. I know you guys are always super busy over there, but, mate, that's super, super important. Can you just tell us, if guys want to look up the paper, the Worth the Weight paper, what's the full title of the paper? Where's the best place for them to find that so guys at home can have a read?
The full title of the paper is, I'm just scroll to the top, Worth the Weight, Post-Weighing Rapid Weight Gain is Not Related to Winning or Losing in Professional Mixed Martial Arts. And it's published in the International Journal of Sport Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism. It only got accepted last week or the week before, so it's not up on the website yet. But if you email me, I am able to send you a copy. So my email is c.kirk at Altius, sport-sports.co.uk.
Excellent. We went over it last time, Chris, but just one more time, if guys want to follow you on the socials, where can they find you?
For social media, it's on Twitter at @ChrisKirk_ASP. And I'm not on Instagram. I downloaded it once, couldn't get my head around it, so I've given up on Instagram. But yeah, follow me on Twitter or email me directly, and I'm more than happy to have a chat with everyone.
Brilliant. Yeah, mate, I just jumped on Twitter from Instagram, and the Twitterverse is not a kind place to be, but so I feel your pain. Anyway, mate, I really appreciate it, and we'll chat soon, mate, no doubt.
Brilliant. Cheers, Jordan.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Chris's work within the combat sports space is proving to be pivotal in furthering our knowledge of what it means to be a mixed martial artist. His latest paper about weight cutting and competitive success is an important piece of literature, as it goes to prove what many practitioners have believed for a long time, that cutting more weight does not necessarily mean you will see a benefit come competition time. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.